Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And Leo.
And tonight we have some news that you don't hear from the mainstream media. And we also have an interview that we recorded last night at our studio in Lakeville, Connecticut on Q103.3. It's an interview with Ellen Brown. And she talks about the solution to the debt, how to solve state debt problems and national debt problems.
And she's the author of Web of Debt, new
Excellent.
Book. And she's actually authored 11 books.
On different topics.
And she's a columnist for Huffington Post. And
Very knowledgeable lady.
Yeah, and you can check her website, webofdebt.com. And very, very fascinating woman.
So stay tuned to listen to that interview. And in the meantime, we'll bring you a little news here. And from the New York Times Green Incorporated, having children brings high carbon impact. Having children is the surest way to send your carbon footprint soaring, according to a new study from statisticians at Oregon State University. The study found that having a child has an impact that far outweighs that of other energy-saving behaviors. Take, for example, a hypothetical American woman who switches to a more fuel-efficient car, drives less, recycles, installs more efficient light bulbs, and replaces her refrigerator and windows with energy-saving models. If she had two children, the researchers found her carbon legacy would eventually rise to nearly 40 times what she had saved by those actions. Clearly, the potential savings from reduced reproduction are huge compared to the savings that can be achieved by changing lifestyles, the report states. The impact of children varies dramatically depending on geography. An American woman who has a baby will generate nearly 7 times the carbon footprint of that of a Chinese woman who has a child, the study found. The calculations take account of the fact that each child is, in turn, likely to have more children. And because the calculations derive from the fertility rate, the expected number of children per woman in various countries, the findings focus on women, although men clearly participate in the decision to have children. In discussions about climate change, we tend to focus on the carbon emissions of an individual over his or her lifetime, said Paul Murtaugh, a professor of statistics at Oregon State University, in a statement accompanying the study's release. Those are important issues, and it's essential that they should be considered. But an added challenge facing us is continuing population growth and increasing global consumption of resources. So now they're telling us we shouldn't have children?
Well, you gotta realize where it's coming from. This is a New York Times article, and they're the spokespeople for global reduction. They're the spokespeople for genocide, basically. They sponsor.
Okay.
They love this stuff. I mean, cap and trade. I mean, they're the globalist spokespeople.
How about this, folks? You have no children. Nobody has any children. There won't be any humans at all. So there'll be no carbon impact.
That's the agenda. That's the whole agenda.
Zero population.
No, they want. You got to understand, please. And I pray that people go to this. Google up Global 2000 report. Global 2000 report. All right. This is a government U.S. government sponsored report. Okay, on global population reduction, okay? And the goal for 2050, is a massive global population reduction by billions upon billions.
Starting right here at home.
They want a two-thirds reduction in global population by the year 2050, all right? And folks,
if that's true, why do you think the media gives so much attention to all these people having so many children? That's all they have in all the magazines.
Because number one, okay, Octomom, okay, is one of the, was ridiculed and is despite, you know, is despicable, okay. The throwing out the insanity of 8 and 10 kids and all this kind of stuff in these times. All right, it's just feeding off this.
All they show in the magazines is Hollywood celebrities, and they're all pregnant, and they all have kids.
Yeah, well, that's
one
fine.
Right after the other.
Well, that's fine, but it sells magazines. Okay.
No, it also sells a lifestyle.
It sells magazines.
They sell a lifestyle too.
They sell a lifestyle, sure. All right, the lifestyle is if you got millions of dollars, you can have kids. If you don't have millions of dollars, tough shit. And the problem...
That isn't quite what they're selling. They're selling the lifestyle, not the fact
what's
that they...
What's the lifestyle? Of having many kids?
Yeah.
Oh, isn't that a wonderful lifestyle?
That's what they're
pushing. I don't think there's any selling there, okay? I think it's just anybody looking at... Number one, anybody who looks at celebrity magazines... is a freaking moron.
Most
okay.
people do.
Yeah, well, they're morons.
You do.
No, I don't.
I see you in the supermarket line reading all of those magazines.
I don't buy them, and I don't subscribe
to
them.
I see you reading them.
Well, how can you not see, you know, Bush screws Condoleezza Rice? How can you not look at that for a minute, okay?
You pick it up and you read it.
But I don't buy it.
You said anyone who reads those magazines.
I'm saying, I may be a moron myself, but the fact is... You know, they're out there. They're pushing this stuff. It's sensationalism. It's crap, okay? And I, you know, as a guy who does this for a virtual living, right, you look at the crap the media puts out, all right? My show could be the most popular show in the universe if all I did was show Angelina Jolie's cleavage and
that isn't what I'm saying.
You know, Britney Spears cellulite and this kind of crap. Okay, but you know, you look at it and you wonder, and then you find out too, and you ask yourself, is this for real or is this not for real? And then you understand that the United States has the top most censored mainstream media in the world. Okay, we don't get crap. Okay. And that's why it's important. Now, here's something. Here's an article that I wanted to read. It's brief, but it's from the Iranian press, for crying out loud. All right? There's nowhere in the United States that this thing came out, okay, anywhere in the mainstream media, all right, and yet it's incredibly important. Here, the U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner has urged Congress to set new statutory debt limit, increasing it from the current $12.1 trillion limit. In a letter to U.S. lawmakers, Geithner called on the U.S. Congress to act swiftly before the current debt limit hits its limits by mid-October. It is critically important that Congress acts before the limit is reached so that citizens and investors here and around the world can remain confident that the United States will always meet its obligations, noted the U.S. Treasury Secretary in his letter published on Monday. All right? That was not mentioned anywhere in the in the news, all right? And yet it's a published letter, all right, by the U.S. Secretary, Treasury Secretary, all right? Meanwhile, analysts have expressed dissatisfaction with the management of U.S. economy, which has created uncertainty about the amount of additional debts that the world's largest financial hub can handle. U.S. officials have criticized President Barack Obama's approach to the current financial crisis, saying that Obama's economic stimulus plan has failed to create equilibrium in the unbalanced, debt-riddled economy. The president has made it clear that as soon as recovery is firmly established, we will bring our fiscal deficit down to a level that is sustainable in the long term. The Wall Street Journal quoted an unnamed Treasury official as saying, if the Congress acts on the Treasury's request, it would mark the second increase in the debt ceiling this year. And the economic stimulus package passed by Congress earlier this year increased the debt ceiling by $789 billion to $12.1 trillion. As of August 7th, the federal debt outstanding totaled roughly $11.7 trillion. Now, you understand why this was never mentioned in the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
If the United States people understood what the hell was going on, there'd be more than riots in these
town hall
meetings. Okay, there'd be armed revolution. All right.
But what they don't understand is that we never pay back our debt anyway.
Well, we talk about this on the show tonight with Ellen Brown, and how debt is insane, and how we
doesn't
can curb that.
Really.
It means nothing, but it means nothing in the sense that, you know, it's created out of midair. But the fact being is that if we set up state banks, all right, all the monies that are involved in lending and so on,
a money would
savings,
have more value.
It would be contained by the taxpayer, by the state taxpayer.
The point is, our money would retain its value.
Of course.
So you would pay a dollar for something rather than $3 for the same thing.
But you wouldn't have inflation.
You would have inflation. But not to the degree that we're going to have.
But you would have inflation, you would have spending, but it would be created by the state bank, which would be totally, you know, controlled by the taxpayer and the state legislature. All right? This is the way, and this is the way to go, and we explained this tonight. But the reason that we're dealing with this is because nobody else will, all right, except Iranian television, okay, Press TV. Go to PressTV.ir. It's amazing. Okay, absolutely amazing what they cover. They cover extensively the United States, Europe.
Well, Al Jazeera does too.
Well, but I'm talking about Press TV. Check out Press TV. Okay, it's PressTV.ir. All right, and then there's one other from this group, Press TV, which I'm impressed with. Central African Republic's children in danger. Central African Republic's children in danger. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, warns that about 700,000 children under the age of 5 are living below the acceptable standards in the Central African Republic. Almost 700,000 children under 5 are living below acceptable standards, and now many are moving toward the outer edge of survival, said Jeremy Hopkins, UN's agency representative in CAR. Recent UNICEF assessments in 3 provinces of the country found that 16% of the children under 5 are acutely malnourished and 6.6% are severely acutely malnourished. This is far above the emergency thresholds of 2% of severe acute malnutrition, said UNICEF. The UN agency is seeking $1.5 million for therapeutic drugs, food, drugs, and other supplies. The money would also pay for a national nutritional survey and training for community health workers. Severely malnourished children have a 9-fold greater risk of dying, according to UNICEF. And the Central African Republic is one of the world's poorest countries and has been racked for years by instability. 1.5 million dollars for therapeutic drugs. The UN agency is seeking. I mean, what the hell is that? I mean, it's enough to pay their UNICEF salaries, essentially. Mm-hmm. $1.5 million is nothing, all right? I mean, you're going to feed 700,000 people? I mean, that's less than $1.50 per person, all right?
Yeah.
I mean, this kind of stuff with the UN is a joke, all right? And, you know, it's a total joke. And, you know, they report this and they report that, but they do absolutely crap. Okay, and, you know, $1.5 million for therapeutic foods. I mean, it's absolutely absurd. So, anyway, that's my rant for tonight. But we're going to, do you have anything else?
No, I think we should go right to our interview, which is excellent.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't want to.
Yeah. So anyway, we're pretty disgusted by this stuff, and like I said,
it makes
me
feel very sad that so many kids and people are starving.
But here it is. This Kate, this new New York Times, Green Ink, Energy, the Environment, and Bottom Line. I mean, I was trying to say that the New York Times is noted as one of the members. Okay, it's publishers and editors.
Yeah,
our members. No, not too far. The Bilderbergers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the Trilaterals.
Some of the
Council of Foreign Relations. They're all, they're all part of it. So this is all Council of Foreign Relations, Trilateral, and the Bilderbergers. These are all the global Illuminati and elitists. All right. And their whole plan, and you can go to hundreds of sites that report this. Their entire plan is for global reduction. All right, and if anybody is interested, please look up the word chemtrails and look up the word Global 2000 report and gasp. Okay, at the overwhelming, government conspiracy that's been going on for years. The Global 2000 report was signed out, was instigated by Jimmy Carter, okay, to study.
Brzezinski.
Yeah, Brzezinski, but Jimmy Carter signed it, okay, and then in 1976. And then in 76, all right, it was further, and the study was undergone and promoted by Brzezinski and Kissinger and so on, all the way up until it was signed off by none other than the grand Ronald Reagan, okay? And this report states that they want a two-thirds reduction in global population by the year 2050, and they're saying that it's unsustainable, blah, 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 blah.
So, folks, that could be you and me.
And they talk about different ways of how to reduce the population through mass, through wars and genocide, through vaccinations, through spreading through aerosol sprayings, through biological weaponry, through food holding back food, food creating food shortages and rationing water supplies and all of this stuff. This is all in this report, folks, signed off by Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. Okay, instigated by Zbigniew Brzezinski and none other than Henry Kissinger, all right?
Yeah.
And on up and up and up, okay? So please look this up, Global 2000 Report.
But in the meantime, we're going to...
look up these other things.
We're going to solve the debt problem.
Also, the UN, and it's Agenda 21, all right? The UN is advising the same kind of things, the same kind of global, population reduction. Okay, so and it's obvious that this marvelous agency wants a $1.5 million, okay, to help 700,000 starving Africans kids. It's absolutely absurd. So take it for what it is, folks. It's a sick world, and you're getting it up the yin yang. So here we go. Here's one way to save the country. Here's one way we can do it. It probably will never happen, but it's a brilliant idea, and we thank Ellen for promoting it as greatly as she has. And we're going to go to her interview now. Unfortunately, the interview starts. We started off the interview broke off on the tape, but it starts. About a minute into the conversation.
Can't really do it without legislation, and legislation will take a year at least. And how legislators are—they're just not going to agree. So we need to work around that somehow. So that's the first part. Problem is just education. They obviously don't quite grasp what we're saying here. You can make 1% on your $16 billion, or you can make 1,000% by turning it into loans.
I thought that. Now, I read and seen that for every $1 that you deposit in a bank, they can lend out $9.
That's if President Obama himself said that.
Yeah. So it's like, to me, I mean, that's absolutely incredible, okay? I mean, that a bank has the right to fabricate money, just make up money.
That's actually where all of our money comes from. I read a really good article recently. It was Australian. It's kind of hard to follow, but Steve Keen was the author. But he pointed out, he showed that if we had no banks, we would have no money. All of our money comes from banks, and they create it as accounting entries on their books.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's all on somebody's computer screen.
Coins. That's the only thing. The only real money out there that's not debt money are coins, and that's money that the government actually creates and just puts out there, and it doesn't have to come back. But even Federal Reserve notes, which is what most people think of as money, are issued by the Federal Reserve, which is a privately owned banking corporation,
mm-hmm.
and lent to the U.S. government and lent to other banks. And then that money is used as the reserves for many times that sum in loans.
So we're actually competing with countries that have state banks. They have, you know, they don't have private banks. Doesn't that put us at a disadvantage?
It does. Well, you know, there's that issue about countries that provide social services that we don't provide, we're at a disadvantage. I mean, if they provide health care and our corporations have to provide health care, obviously we can't compete with them. Or if they provide a good pension so that
mm-hmm.
they don't have to, you know, tax for Social Security, we can't compete with that. But, yeah, so the banks are the same way. I was just reading that China is, although we think of them as, you know, communist and totalitarian and all this,
mm-hmm.
they're actually, their banks are actually serving the people. That's, they're set up that way. So they haven't let their banks take off and make these horrible profits like ours have. They're making the banks actually make loans to the consumers. And therefore, now that there's a global credit crunch and they see that, they've turned their resources inwards, but they can dictate to their banks. So they tell their banks, you're going to make loans for infrastructure and you're going to make loans to these individuals, the small businesses and so forth, and they're doing it. So they too are, I mean, they know there's a credit crisis, but they're dealing with it quite well.
Mm-hmm.
That puts us
at a disadvantage.
Yeah. I have to ask you a question about this, because this confounds me, is do we actually have to pay this money back that we borrow?
Who's we? You mean
the federal government, as a
American people.
American people.
No, it's clear we never will. $12 trillion debt has been growing. If you look at those little charts, I mean, it hasn't really been paid off since 1836, I think, when got annoyed at the second U.S. bank and pulled all the money out and paid off the debt and put the money into state banks. But it was quite low until World War II, and at the end of World War II, you can see these charts. Of course, that's after the Federal Reserve came in,
right.
Then there was the Great Depression, and the Federal Reserve decided we were never going to have any more of these Great Depressions, and so their solution was to pump more and more money into the system every time there was any little recession.
But they were the ones that caused the Great Depression because they stopped lending. All right, they were the ones that deliberately stopped the lending.
Would you agree with that?
Ben Bernanke said that it was the Federal Reserve's fault, and Milton Friedman said that. Although this Steve Keen article that I just read said actually that we give the Fed too much credit. They don't really have that power, that it's really the tail wagging the dog, that the Fed really reacts. They're not really proactive.
It
was the banking system that messed it up.
Mm-hmm.
So then the Fed's response after that was to just keep pumping money in the system. Well, when you pump money in the system, that means pumping debt into the system. So that's why you have this exponential curve of debt, and there's no way we could ever pay that off. That really what it is that is our money supply. We have $12 trillion in debt, and we have roughly a $12 trillion M3 money supply.
And that's only the federal debt. That's not the national debt. National debt's like $53 trillion or something, an insane figure. But the of all the credit cards and mortgages and everything else that are out there, but just the federal debt, okay, is $12 trillion. All right. Now, the frightening thing that I just heard, that I just read today, was that Bernanke admitted that $1.5 trillion issued by the Federal Reserve has they refuse or have that are saying they don't know where it went. $1.5 trillion years in the recent thing, yeah. And these monies were sent overseas. These monies were sent to other countries, supposedly, and to other countries.
Now, how was it sent? Was it sent as a blip on a computer screen?
Yeah, of course. But and from what I've also read is that there's only about there's something in excess of I think 10 or 12 trillion dollars in actual dollars. They're actually printed dollars, okay? And the debt that this country owes is $53 trillion. So, we owe more money than actually even exists, all right? So how can we justify that? How can we justify that?
Well, if we never pay it back, I guess, wasn't it Cheney who said it didn't really matter?
Yeah, Cheney was the one that said
that. That was the point, is that we create the money. It's created as a debt, and so it's never expected to be paid back if you're the federal government.
Right.
But everybody else has to balance their books, including the states.
Well, let's say what would happen if all of a sudden the banks crawled in their notes on the federal government, all right? I mean, actually, all we'd have to do is close the banks down, wouldn't we? I mean, we could officially close the damn banks down. Get rid of them.
So,
you know, put the CEOs in jail. I mean, for criminal lending.
If the concept is that we never really have to pay back our federal money that we owe, then this issue of health care costing so much money is ridiculous.
It's absurd because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how much it costs. It costs $100 trillion. I mean, it's all paper and nothing money.
Am I understanding correctly then?
Well, if the problem is that we do pay in a different way. We pay in terms of inflation. So obviously, we have a $12 trillion debt, but look at what a cup of coffee costs compared to what it costs. And I wasn't here at the end of, I won't even admit that. But anyway, look what it cost like 50 years ago.
Yeah, you weren't getting $5 or $6 lattes from Starbucks or something, you know what I mean?
Well, that's true. Yeah. But what I mean is the more debt money you have out there competing for goods, the higher the price of the goods.
Yeah, no, that's true.
I do remember 25 cent a gallon gasoline.
I do too.
So now it's like more than 10 times that, maybe.
Yeah.
12 or 13 times that.
Yeah, and you know, it's only been in the last 10 years that it's been obscene, you know.
Well, that's how we've paid, is in terms of inflation. But it certainly makes more sense. Here's how I would solve that whole problem.
Okay.
I think when the Chinese and Japanese are demanding that we comply with different demands, or otherwise they're going to dump our bonds.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we should do is buy the bonds back from them through the Federal Reserve. In other words, with money created out of nothing, because the Federal Reserve rebates all the interest after they deduct their costs to the federal government. So it's almost interest-free money. It's the cheapest money we can get is to fund through our own Federal Reserve. But we don't do that, and the reason is the banks.
Now, wait a minute. The cheapest money that we could get would be to issue our own money.
Yeah, well, if you can get Congress to do that, that's what they should do,
Which is what the Constitution says we are supposed to do.
What are you going
to
do about it? So what if you...
Constitutionally, though, that's what we're supposed to do, isn't it?
Sorry?
Constitutionally, that's what we're supposed to do.
Issue our own money? Yeah.
Issue our own money. You know, the banks aren't supposed to issue our money.
Yeah, right.
So
if you bought back... Actually, the Federal Reserve did buy back $300 billion worth of long-term government bonds earlier this year. And so in that sense, it is funding the budget, and that's what it should do, I think. Because rather than borrowing from the Chinese, who you have to pay several percent interest to the Fed, you're only paying under 0.5% interest.
Or no interest, actually, right?
And they deduct their costs, and it comes out to something like 0.5%. But hey, they're an agency, you know. It's basically you're just keeping the agency going. So it's definitely cheaper to have your own bank, in other words, that funds your operations. It makes a certain accounting sense to do it as a loan rather than as issuing it directly, because if you're always issuing money, you're going to inflate the system. You're going to have to at least take it back as taxes. But if you issue it as loans, you can kind of keep track there. Like, say, say you monetize, say, infrastructure. So you say you want to build a dam.
Yep.
So you figure out the cost of the dam. You write it up as a loan, and you write the dam as an asset on one side of your books, and you write the cost of the dam on the other side. You draw from that account, pay for the dam, workers and materials, and then the electricity you get from the dam, the fees from that go back and pay off the loan. So you have a circular thing, and you can sort of see, well, this costs. It's like a community currency system where you borrow from there.
But let's look at it this way. If you only have $14 trillion in actual dollars in existence, all right, and you have $53 trillion in debt, how does this even equate? I mean, you don't have enough money in the system to even pay off the debt, ever.
Well, you don't have enough dollar bills, but the money is out there in the sense that that debt is money that's circulating out there. Debts are created by writing them up as into a deposit account of somebody. Like if you go into the bank and you take out a loan, they'll write that into your account. And then you can write a check on that money. Let's say you want to buy a house.
Yep.
So, and you want to borrow $500,000. So they'll write that into your account. Then you'll write a check for $500,000 to the seller of the house. And now he's got that money. He'll put that in his account. And then he'll spend it. And so that's going to go out into the community as real money. And that's, so to pay off that debt, let's say all that comes to $53 trillion or whatever it is, all those various debts.
Okay.
Supposedly that's what it is.
Just, all those loans are revolving. You know, they go out and they come back, and they go out and they come back. But I doubt that it's 50. I mean, I know there's all these obligations, like our future commitments for Social Security and stuff like that.
No. The $12 trillion is just the federal debt. The national debt is $53 trillion. The national debt, all the credit cards, all the mortgages, all the commercial mortgages, all the mortgages, all the lending that's out there, all the money that the Americans owe, okay, everywhere, is $53 trillion. All the money that we have that's in existence is $14 trillion in actual paper currency around the world.
Now, I'd be surprised if there's that much. I think it's 3% of M3, so it's something like, it used to be, what would that be? That's like $300 billion or something like that.
No, actually, I remember Andrew Goss, economist there, he said there was actually $14 trillion in actual currency existing, paper currency existing in the world, all right? And he says American currency. And of that, but we owe $53 trillion as a nation, our credit, as all the people in the United States put together, owe $53 trillion. That's big.
Okay. I guess I would just...
Staggering. Yeah, it's absolutely staggering.
I can't even... It just boggles my mind. I can't even imagine what that amount would look like.
No, I don't think anybody can. That's why it's just,
It doesn't mean anything to me.
Well, they're talking about no longer... there won't be any... $1 trillion will be... it won't be used. There will now be... Quadrillions will start being used. Okay, as we start understanding monies.
So my question to you is, besides California, where you've been talking, are you getting other people to listen to you because you have some real solutions?
Well, people write to me, like someone called from New Mexico, mm-hmm. who was working for the legislature there, and he was interested, and he said New Mexico has just been decimated. They've been mined, and so the environment has been ruined by this mining, and they took the profits from that and put them into Wall Street, and like largely into Lehman Brothers.
Oh, man, that was
a mistake. Bankrupt.
Yeah.
There's nobody to sue. Wall Street, he said, Wall Street's like God, you know,
just take
the judgment you get. So you're just told, well, you've been wiped out, and what can you do about it? So they definitely, they're a small state, and they could pull something like that off easier than California probably could, because it's so big, it's just got a lot of interest to juggle. So they're definitely looking for a way to protect themselves against these predators,
right,
and to keep their money in the state.
And
admit Michigan, I guess they're making some progress with their legislators. I mean, there are different people, different places.
Mm-hmm.
And then people write to me from, like, there are two Indian tribes in Canada that wrote, and they're interested in setting something up. So a lot of people are thinking along those lines.
Yeah. Well, that's good news. That's very positive.
So tribal nations, that would be another thing I would think would be.
They're in a very good position because
yeah.
they're sovereign. So who's going to step in and say they can't do it?
That's right.
And also some of them have some money.
Yeah, right.
To put in there to begin with, which would be good. Any movement with politicians? Have you had any inquiries from politicians or congressmen or senators on your knowledge about this?
Well, we've approached, just here in California, we've approached our local senators.
Mm-hmm.
Marcy Winograd is running for Congress, and she was the one that organized that conference call that I mentioned.
Oh, she did.
Yeah.
Is she running again? I know we had her on before.
Yep.
We had her on when she was running about 4 years ago.
Yeah, she's running again.
Oh, good for her.
Is she running against Harmon again?
Yeah,
unfortunately. Anybody running against Feinstein?
I don't actually know.
Yeah. I know Cindy Sheehan was running against Pelosi, but that kind of fell apart for her. Somebody should be doing something there. But anyway, I getting back to the situation. If aside from the state bank, all right, is there any possible way that these states can balance their budgets without decimating federal or social programs?
Well, this is what I'm just now writing on. There is one possibility. You know, I was trying to, just as you called, I was trying to find the figure for, I've heard that something like 45% of the gross domestic product is now financial products, the financial sector. Well, that's the only product that isn't taxed, that the financial products are not taxed. In other words, stocks, bonds, derivatives. Derivatives are the big ones that we want to get.
Well, that was Ralph Nader's idea.
Well, yeah, he came up with a commodity.
Broached many times. Well, ever since with the Tobin tax was the original,
right.
proposal, but it never gets anywhere because everybody loves playing in the stock market, and the market was always doing well.
But he said even if you charged a penny a stock, even if you taxed a penny on a stock,
uh-huh.
he says even if there was a penny tax on all stocks traded. He said that would come up to billions and billions of dollars to the federal treasury.
The day traders, the people that are trading hourly,
right.
mm-hmm.
they're the ones that are doing all the turnover, and they're the speculators.
Yeah.
So if you put a small tax like that on trades, you wouldn't hurt the ordinary investor who goes out and buys his favorite stock and plans to hold on to it. You would just hurt tax those people who are.
Well, you tax the institutional investors. Okay, these guys that flip stuff over every, you know, they've got these things now. We read an article the other night.
Supercomputers
that trade in nanoseconds, you know, and they're destroying. They're destroying.
They get a jump on the market and everybody.
Their competition. But I mean, you're talking huge institutional traders, and these things could possibly. I mean, the taxes that I mean, they're trading millions and billions of dollars
within seconds.
Within seconds.
And they're manipulating the market.
But not only that, I mean, they're just trading daily. I mean, you know, your hedge funds and everybody else. I mean, can you?
That's why the Tobin tax would be difficult to pass because they own Congress. We already know Goldman Sachs owns Congress,
right.
And they're the ones doing. They were the ones that were suing because somebody had. They were afraid that somebody had stolen that program. So I saw that the literature said the concern was that somebody unethical might get a hold of this program who would be manipulating markets for their own ends. Well, why do we think that Goldman Sachs is ethical?
I know. Well, Goldman Sachs was doing it.
But we don't.
Yeah, they were doing it, for crying out loud. I mean, they're all doing it. So it's like, but I mean, there's no ethics in the finance industry. We know that. The crooks and thieves. And, I mean, it's gone, gone. But Wall Street is no. I mean, how can they justify? How can they possibly justify these insane bonuses to these dead banks, to these losing banks? I mean, I can't understand it. Have you rationalized any of that yet?
Yeah, and bonuses that are higher than their profits.
Yeah.
I just read that. I couldn't believe it. And they have the nerve to come out with these that they're performance based or based on the fact that these people are needed and are so good at their job. When is a failing report make you good at your job?
Or fail your bank is failing. You're destroyed. You destroyed your own company. So now it's time to get a bonus.
I thought the kid that got all F's didn't graduate.
Right, they're definitely rewarding failure, and the banks that have done well, they're not.
Unless his name is Bush or Kennedy, you know, then they graduate Harvard, or Yale, and
anyway, go ahead.
Bush or Kennedy, you can get away with this, but anybody else, no.
So the banks that are dealing with the regular market forces, they don't have the advantages of this TARP money. They're really struggling, and when those banks go bankrupt, they just go under. And the ones that do well are struggling as well. I mean, that's why we could technically set up our own private banks and compete with the big Wall Street banks. But the problem is they're bigger than we are, and they're going to be very difficult to compete with. And a lot of little ethical banks, I mean, that actually intend to try to help the community, they go bankrupt, even though they have the best of intentions, and their plan is to back good community things like alternative energy.
Well, that's why we need a state bank. We need somebody big with big roots that can withstand the competition. That's a perfect answer. I wish Congress would pick it up. How are the credit unions doing right now?
I mean, I've read stuff where a lot of them aren't doing well at all. But have you?
Well, it's that same problem because they're competing in this very bad market,
right.
And they don't have any of those TARP advantages, and they're small. They're just little small community.
Yeah, credit unions. And
that's why it seems to me you want something that's very stable and that everybody's so annoyed at the banks right now. If a state set up its own bank and said that it was that you were going to be helping your state by moving your money into that bank, everybody would do it. I mean,
sure they would.
Flood in, especially if they got, like, lower interest rates and better
benefits. Yeah, every bank in the state would close down, you know, for lack of deposits. But, you know, you refinance your loans with a state bank and pay off the bank and get out from under. But, I think state bank is a brilliant idea.
They could do other things. Like, they could buy up a lot of this foreclosed real estate and rent it back to the owners.
Yeah,
they could do a lot of
That's true.
Things that are beneficial to the people.
Yeah. But it bothers me that you can't. Nobody seems to be. It doesn't seem to be registering with Congresses or state reps or anybody.
Well,
a few. But for some reason, even though you show a stellar example of North Dakota to people, and they just like you know. Oh yeah.
Well, I think as far as I know, I was the first to raise this issue, so it hasn't been around that long. And in North Dakota, it took them years. Of course, they didn't have the internet, but they didn't have the mass media that we have here, and so they were going door to door. But there's actually a movie on it. It's called Northern Lights, and it was a Hollywood movie made in the 70s, and it's like half in Swedish with subtitles. So these were these very independent farmers, and they had no intention of joining any group. Sounded like socialism or something. They didn't want any of that. They just wanted to do their farming. But one by one, these farmers were losing their farms, and it wasn't fair. Their grain was good grain, and they were selling it to the granaries, and the granaries wouldn't take it. The granaries and the railroad people and the Wall Street bankers were all the same thing. And the Wall Street people wanted, they wanted to put these farmers in foreclosure.
Right.
And they were succeeding. And so the farmers just finally got. They could see that was what was happening and that the only way they would preserve their land was to band together. So they did, and they managed to get their man elected. They called it the Nonpartisan League because it really wasn't partisan. It was just a bunch of farmers trying to protect their own
land,
their own state territories, keep their money from going out of state. They wanted to keep it in state.
Well, they obviously had a good policy, a visionary there who has a leader. you know, that group or something.
Well, but that's the thing, you got to just keep pounding and pounding. I mean, you got to keep getting that idea out there until it seems...
sinks in.
A lot more, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just amazing that it hasn't been picked up there anywhere by any mainstream. Have you any mainstream news outlet picking a story up?
Well, no. Mother Jones had an article about the Bank of North Dakota after the author interviewed me, and then I told him about that bank, so he went and interviewed the president of the bank and did a long story on it.
I keep hoping to see you on one of the television talk shows there. You know, defending the state bank concept, but I don't know. I'm still hoping for you.
Thanks. Well, I think it's just a new concept, and it'll take some.
Well, you got to keep pushing it and keep talking about it, and keep maybe working on California to get, maybe it would, if it took there and people would see what a success it is, then other states would quickly follow, I'm sure.
Yeah, that would be, in California, is the third largest economy in the world. I think a state bank there would have tremendous power, not only power, but tremendous benefit.
Right. And something smaller, a municipality, or Michigan actually is making good strides, so they might be the first ones because they're so
desperate. Oh, there's a struggle, yeah. 15%.
Their economy is in even worse shape than California's.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Oh, boy.
But that's what I think. If just one state did it, it would be...
quickly others would follow, I think.
I think so. But I wanted to, before we end tonight, I just wanted to mention you can reach Ellen at webofdebt.com. Is that correct?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Webofdebt.com. And your book
there on my website. So.
Right. And you've authored 12 books. Is that correct?
11.
11 books. Okay.
She's probably writing another one.
You're working on another
still
one.
In my... fingers in my computer.
Well, we sure do appreciate you being on. Well, thank you.
And thank you. It's great talking to you.
Yeah, hope that your books do well. And remember, Web of Debt and webofdebt.com. And
thanks for coming up with those solutions. I hope someone pushes it more and we adopt them.
Well, we believe in it, and I don't know why others don't. So we'll keep pushing it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thank
Good
you.
Good night,
Bye-bye.
That was Ellen Proarm talking to us about the solution for our terrible economic state. It's a state bank, or you could even have one on a national level too.
Yeah.
So
we want to thank everybody for joining us. You can join us Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday night on lasteelshow.org. Again, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday at 8 to 9 on lasteelshow.org. And
thanks for being with
us. Okay, and that was Ellen Brown. And highly recommend that you go to her website and possibly purchase her book, which is called The Web of Debt. And it's a great explanation of what we are doing here, why the country is in the shape that it's in, and what we can actually do about it to get ourselves out of this mess. And I highly recommend that you go to it. Excuse me one second here. I'm going to try to pull something else up. I thought of actually reading her article, but I realized that I heard this. Before we close tonight, it's a short article, but it was published in the... HuffingtonPost.com. And it was published August 5th. It's called the Public Option in Banking: How We Can Beat Wall Street at Its Own Game. And it says here, President Obama has repeated his call for a public option in healthcare in order to create some competition for the insurance companies and keep them honest. We, the people, need to call for a public option in banking in order to create some competition for the private banks and keep them honest. In Wall Street's latest affront to the public trust, the nine mega banks graced with $125 billion in taxpayer bailout money under the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, were reported last week to be paying out billions of dollars in bonuses to their executives. At least 4,793 bankers and traders received more than $1 million each in bonus payments, although it was one of Wall Street's worst years on record. After months of investigating banker compensation, New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo said on July 30th, the repeated explanation from bank executives that bonuses are tied to performance in a manner designed to promote national economic growth does not appear to be accurate. And to say that it was an understatement would be an understatement. The bonuses paid to the executives not only were not tied to national economic growth, but were not even tied to some reasonable percentage of company profits. In fact, they were generally greater than the net income of the banks. Morgan Stanley, for example, had $1.7 billion in earnings and paid $4.75 billion in bonuses. Goldman Sachs had $2.3 billion in earnings and paid $4.8 billion in bonuses. J.P. Morgan Chase had $5.6 billion in earnings and paid $8.69 billion in bonuses. J.P. Morgan's largest involved showering 1,626 of its favorite executives and traders with bonuses of $1 million or more. For more people, a bonus in a few hundred, for most people, a bonus is a few hundred dollars at Christmas time. $1 million is what you work a lifetime to try to save, and few people reach that goal. Even Citigroup and Merrill Lynch, which have been called zombie banks, paid $5.33 billion and $3.6 billion in bonuses, respectively, although they lost more than $27 billion each in earnings. The bar for merit is apparently so low that you're entitled to a bonus if your zombie bank simply keeps breathing. These blatantly inflated bonuses are just the last in a litany of abuses by those profligate banks that nearly destroyed our economic system. If the derivatives on their books were marked to market, valued at what they would fetch on the market, the banks would be bankrupt and their employees would be out of a job. Instead, they are being allowed to inflate the value of their toxic assets and sell them to the U.S. government at the inflated value. When they have taken the money they got from the government to these inflated prices and paid back the TARP money they received, allowing them to boost inflated earnings and reward themselves with inflated bonuses. Many people feel that these bankers are thieves stealing from the public till who should be looking at jail time. But who is there to stop their parade of outrages? No one in Congress, the White House, or the news media is calling them on the carpet for it. The Senator Dick Durbin said recently, Wall Street owns Congress, and that is also true of the major media. We may not be able to stop them, but we can join them. We the people need to play the banker game ourselves. Even corporate giants such as General Motors and Walmart have now gotten into the banking game and are easing their credit problems by forming their own banks. The U.S. public sector is late to the party. States, countries, public universities could take the lucrative system the private banking industry has created for itself and turn it to productive use in the public interest, keeping the banks honest in some public competition. In President Obama's July 17th weekly address, he repeated his call for a public option in health care in order to increase competition and keep insurance companies honest and to put an end to the worst practices of insurance industry. The same call needs to be made for a public option in banking. In some countries, publicly owned banks have operated alongside privately owned banks for decades. And in those countries, the current crisis has served to show that public banks generally do a better job of serving the people, protecting their interests, than the private counterparts. In Canada, the trendsetters in public banking in the province of Alberta, Alberta's publicly owned banking system called Alberta Treasury Branches, or ATB, was initiated during the Great Depression to give the private banks a run for their public money. And according to a government publication titled, These Are the Facts, the Authentic Record of the Alberta Progress, 1935 to 1948. The Treasury Branch system enables the people to pool their financial resources and to use these resources to their mutual benefit, thereby enabling them to progressively free themselves from the stranglehold of the existing financial monopoly. These Treasury Branches provide effective competition for chartered banks, thereby ensuring banking services at reasonable rates. From 1929 to 1933, the average annual income in Alberta had fallen from $548 to $212, a staggering 61% drop. Can you imagine that? In 1929, Alberta's annual income was $548 and dropped to $212. Interest payments continued to bleed the farmers of cash. Taxes had increased and taxes increased. In 1935, Albertans decided they wanted a change and swept the Alberta Social Credit Party into power. And in 1938, the system of Alberta Treasury branches were set up literally as a branch of provincial government. And the state goal of ATB was to provide the people of alternative facilities to gaining their... This also happened in North Dakota. And from 1929 to 1933, in India, public sector banks also operate alongside private sector banks. In China, private sector banking has also made some inroads, but state-owned banks still predominate. And in the United States, the trendsetter in public banking is the state of North Dakota, which has owned its own bank for nearly a century, and one of the only two states, along with Montana, that are currently not facing budget shortfalls. In theory and practice, the proof is in the pudding. A bank charter brings with it privilege of creating credit simply as an accounting entry on bank's books. And it is the theory, but there is nothing so pervasive as putting it to the test. Like the public option in healthcare, we need to pit the public banking option against the private banking option and see which works best. My money is on the public sector. And that was by Ellen Brown. And you can check her out, please, at that article on Huffington Post. But go to just check out Ellen Brown, and you'll see a slew of things. But primarily, you can go to webofdebt.com, which is her website, and see parts of her book, bio, and so on. And at the end of the show, I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight, and have a pleasant evening. Good night.